Welcome to episode 130 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including the Pico 8. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uoso. Good evening.
Happy Sega to you.
Yes. That's right. This is my prized possession from the Tokyo Sega store. My lovely blue Sega mug.
I was just telling you before we started recording, I've been reading up on some of the history of Sega, which is quite fascinating. I've been meaning to look for some recommendations on like a history book. I'm sure they're out there, but I'd like to get a more involved history book on the history of Sega. So if you have any recommendations, let me know.
Yeah, Sega is near and dear to my heart. Oh, good old service games. I think it started out like post-World War II for like arcade machines for American servicemen, but eventually changed to an all Japanese ownership, and then would go on to create many, many consoles even before the Sega Master System. But yeah, I'd like to know that as well, so we can compete to find out more Sega history.
Absolutely. Well, more on that later, but for now, we have three courses of games coming up on the podcast today. As usual, we'll start off with the appetizer, where we talk about some sort of game-related news and topics of interest. Do you want to kick us off there?
Yeah, and the good thing about this format is that like we can kind of like shift around the size of these features. I think last episode, our appetizer segment was pretty long. Lots of industry news going on right now. I think pretty much the only industry news that I followed this week was, of course, Game Awards happened. We're not going to go into that. There. But lots people are talking about that. Obviously, that happened. Expedition 33 pretty much won everything. But I don't really have an opinion about that. I need to go back to Expedition 33 and finish it. So my little news tidbits for my appetizer are pretty short. I had a sort of a crisis with my original PS1000 PS Vita. It wasn't holding a charge anymore, so I was deathly sad because that's one of my favorite machines, which I still use. And I ended up ordering a $10 battery off of AliExpress, and I got out the old toolkit, and I managed to replace the battery myself, and it's good as new. I had to redo some of the hardware to re-enable the hack on it, but I still only play game software that I own, and pretty much I'm only using it to play PS Vita games now, ironically, because my Retroid Pocket 5 runs everything up to PSP fantastic. PS Vita, it won't consistently run everything, so I might as well. It's pretty much the only handheld where I need that dedicated one to play the dedicated games. Well, maybe 3DS as well. 3DS, you still need the actual hardware. I'm not going to drop $400 to get the Iron Thor or anything like that just yet.
Yeah, my Vita is still refusing to turn on at all, unfortunately, so it needs some more serious surgery. But at this point, it's probably cheaper and easier to just buy a new one of the many retro devices out there.
If it's just the battery, it was a quick fix. I can send you a link to the...
I'm not sure if it's the battery. It might be something else entirely. It's not turning on at all.
Got it. That is a challenge. All right, and then beyond that, I don't know. I was telling you I was desperately trying to buy something new with all my money around Boxing Day,
a hole in your pocket.
Black Friday. And I just didn't find anything because I'm also trying to be reasonable. So basically, I'm just sitting on my hands, playing old retro handhelds I've purchased, really enjoying them. I settled back on the TrimUI Brick as my fave of pretty much all of them that I bought for retro games. So for games older than, I don't know, like PSP, I guess non-widescreen games, let's say. It's still fantastic. The screen's great, not too big, and I'm really enjoying that. And if anyone is interested in picking up some lightly used retro handhelds, I'm gonna start selling them. I have actually sold a couple already, and I'm feeling good about that. I enjoyed playing with them, so I don't feel like it was a waste of my time, and I'm trying to find them a new home. So that's my outlook on life at the end of 2025. Just lighten the load and enjoy what I own and play some good old games.
Yeah, well, perhaps I'll talk to you a little bit about that after we're done recording here. I'm looking to experiment a little more myself. I'm still mostly just using that Nintendo Online feature. It's just, as always, the ease of use is going to trump any sort of features or like new devices and everything. Just whatever's the easiest option there, I'm gonna take the path of least resistance, right?
It's really good. I was really poo-pooing the Nintendo Classics as a prospect. I thought, well, this is like cheapo Netflix for games, but it's only old stuff, poo-poo, you know. But it turns out it's really good because they keep adding new stuff. And it's not earth-shattering titles. Maybe the biggest news was when they released Switch 2 and they announced the GameCube titles. There were some big ones in there, like Wind Waker. But beyond that, they just keep steadily releasing some fun ones, like really solid ones, like Game Boy Advance, Fire Emblem, and things like that. Some older, like, Nobunaga's Ambition and stuff from the SNES. So some real kind of, like, deep cuts and side titles that I'm interested in checking out. So I think it's a solid service.
The release schedule is a little slower than I'd probably like. They did just announce a couple this week. I think it was it Wario Lands on the GameCube, I believe. I'm not familiar with that game at all. And I think there's a Rayman game coming out on from the 64, which I didn't play.
Right, yeah. So it's actually getting better and better. Now, they are secretly removing titles here and there that I've noticed. I think they got rid of the Star Wars N64 titles.
I'm sure there's licensing issues, yeah. And, I mean, yeah, exactly. Phantasy Star, as we'll be talking about later, Phantasy Star 4 is the only one left where previously all four of that series had been on the Sega Genesis version of Nintendo Online.
So, like any streaming service, you know, Netflix and things like that included.
You don't own anything.
Exactly. You're at the whim of whatever the service has on hand. But I think for something like $25 Canadian per year, I think it's worth it to play some officially licensed retro titles on the systems you already own.
Certainly. Yeah, well, I've got a few retro games that I've finished and banked up for the next few episodes that I'll be trickling out. But more on that later. Yeah, so I mean, as regards to current news, I mean, I've tried to avoid most of the discourse around the Game Awards and everything else happening this week. There have been several announcements, both at that and other various satellite events that have been happening this last week. I think the Day of the Devs, there was a wholesome indie stream and a few other things that have led to a bunch of announcements coming out this week, basically, that I've been checking out. A couple of demos I've tried and really enjoyed, so just quickly running through those. I mean, first of all, so my intro there makes sense, a compilation called Corgi Space, which is a compilation of Pico 8 games. So the Pico 8 is a little virtual console that we've spoke about previously. I think at the Vancouver Game Garden, there was another compilation there called the Plush Girls Game Dozen, I think it was called. Plush Girls Dozen, yeah. So it's definitely something in the water between that and things like UFO 50, of these sort of compilations of smaller retro games that play with some really iterative experimental game design with the limitations of more retro hardware, shall we say. So that was quite interesting. Another one that I really enjoyed, that I did play the demo of, is called Bistro. And this is, I didn't actually write down the name of the developer, but there is a demo of that I've tried. And another thing I'd spoke about at one of the recent episodes was with all of the deck building obsession in digital games right now, something that I think has been underutilized is the concept of trick taking. We've not really seen much trick taking in digital video games, but this is definitely playing with that, in that you're basically, I mean, it's one of those cozy games. There's a bunch of animal people in a town, you're cooking meals for all the townsfolk and making friends, but you're basically then empowering these characters to go out into the wild and fight monsters in this deck building mechanic, basically. And like the meal you cook is sort of influencing the deck of cards that they have, and then those cards are basically a trick-taking game that you're playing. And it's fairly simple. Like, you're sort of breezing through those cards pretty quickly. It's not like a long, say, the Spire match or anything. But I thought it's an underutilized mechanic, and I think it's adding some new takes on both trick-taking and cooking games that I think merges really well with a really nice presentation. So I'm very curious to see more of Bistro.
Yeah, interesting. Is that a multiplayer only game if it's trictating?
No, you know, it's actually like a solo game. You're playing against monsters. Like, the monsters will play a card and you have to try and match the suit of that card, basically. And like you have to match the suit, and then the difference in numbers is the damage that you do, essentially. There is some twists to that, like there's this color wheel, and you don't have to necessarily match the colors. There'll be some like opposite colors that you can also use to interact with it in some funky ways. So I didn't dig into it too deep. As with most demos, I only played long enough to know that I want to play the full game, and so I'll wait for that, basically. So I like what I've seen so far.
Fair. Sounds cool.
Yeah, I mean, one you may have seen, Mark, is a much bigger profile game called Pragmata from Capcom. Have you seen much of this?
Yeah, I watched the major trailers from the Game Awards.
I mean, this has been announced for quite some time ago. There's been trailers circling.
Yeah, I watched the earlier trailer too, and it's basically the spaceman with the robot girl with a giant jacket on. The giant robot blonde girl or something like that.
Yes.
That's basically the visuals, if you...
Yeah, I mean, it's playing something like Dead Space or any number of these sort of third-person shooters, you know, gruff white guy shooting robots, which isn't anything new, but you have this basically companion, this young child companion. I mean, it's easy to dismiss, you know, escort quest games. But I think, for one, that character is pretty deeply integrated into the mechanics of this game, where you're using her to hack the robots. And it's very much a, you know, pat your head while rubbing your stomach. You have to like hold down one of the mouse buttons and like play this mini game of moving through this sort of grid to hack the robots, open up their weak spot, and then shoot them. So it's quite interesting, the back and forth, and it's surprisingly seamless. You pick it up pretty quickly, I found. And the other surprise was that the character, Diana, I think it is, the child robot, is actually pretty genuine, both in the performance and the writing. Like, I mean, as a you know, a parent of a similarly aged kid, it felt like a pretty genuine, well-written character, basically.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I got, well, first off, just kind of thematically, I got, what was it, BioShock vibes with the kind of the Bill Culkin figure and the little girl kind of like hanging on for dear life, and kind of like the doom and gloom of it all, just from an aesthetic point of view. And then knowing Capcom, and I believe this is a Capcom game, their sort of big space series before this was Lost Planet.
Right. I was trying to think of that name. Yeah.
And, it, you know, that series has its ups and downs, but I remember the first couple of entries being pretty darn solid action games. And it's just kind of remarkable how far Capcom has come. It seems like as one of the few kind of successful AAA Japanese devs that's able to keep putting out good stuff year after year without major hiccups. I know that there was some controversy around Street Fighter V and VI, but they're not doing face palm stuff like Square Enix is at every turn. They're not making these ridiculous financial bets on terrible technology.
They've definitely had some flops. I mean, there was Resident Evil Online game, I think there was. I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah, there's a couple of those multiplayer entries. I'm not saying that they don't put out successful products. What I'm saying is that they generally have quality games that have more wins than losses, and they're not pissing off their fan base too much, or nearly as much as some of the other Japanese publishers, which are few and far between. Like Konami, I feel like, is just kind of making a comeback in people's good
graces. Maybe it was Konami I'm thinking of, yeah.
thanks to the Metal Gear Delta remake, Metal Gear Solid 3 remake, of course, Delta, and Silent Hills F, which is, I think, generally well received from the public. So they're just getting back into good graces out of pachinko land, and Square Enix, like I said, just doing the facepalm moves over and over and over. So we'll see. Maybe Capcom will surprise us all. I'm not sure about that Mega Man game, but I'm going to hopefully optimistic.
I haven't seen that one yet. I don't have any nostalgia for Mega Man.
Fair.
Yeah, I mean, very just quickly, in tangenting on from Japanese studios, there was an announcement from, I think it's a new studio, I can't remember the name, but they've got a game coming out called Orbitals, a new Tokyo-based studio. It's very much 2D animation, inspired by a lot of retro anime. Did I say the name? Orbitals is the name of the game. That looks quite interesting, playing on a lot of nostalgia there, obviously, but quite slick in its animation.
Yeah, that trailer was mind-blowing. It just looks like 90s anime, like a rediscovered old title. Kind of like Space One, like Macross or Dirty Pair or something like that. Go watch it if you haven't seen the Orbitals trailer yet.
Yeah, I think that's about it for the announcements for these last couple of weeks. I don't want to focus too much on upcoming games.
Sounds fair. Well, it is the end of year. So you either talk about stuff that's coming up in the future, or talking about the end of year recap. I don't know if we're going to do that. Is this our last episode of the year, you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I still definitely got lots more to talk about, but I could also do with a break. So we'll see. We'll talk that through later.
There you go. We'll keep you on tenterhooks there. Maybe we'll have a bonus episode before the end of the year. And maybe we might do kind of like our personal game of 2025.
Yeah, I mean,
playing a lot of new stuff.
Yeah, it's mostly going to be retro games for me. I've been played very few games of 2025, unfortunately. But just one final little bit of news that I wanted to cover. I mean, something I've been meaning to talk about for quite some time is a group called the Video Game History Foundation. I think it was actually near the start of the year. They put out an announcement that they'd uploaded a whole bunch of classic video game magazines and production materials and basically put them into a public archive, which was a huge resource for games preservation, basically, not just the games themselves, but the conversations around these games and the making of them that I found particularly interesting. I've been just looking into some old reviews of the game I'm going to be talking about very soon, but also just fascinating to see how some of those opinions have changed. And it's always, I'm very much in favor of preserving what information we can on the internet. But they did just announce as part of one of the conferences this last week that they have basically found and restored an old NES game called Excavator. That's Excavator without an E, starting with the letter X. And they're releasing that as Excavator 2025. They're releasing it on a physical NES cartridge in collaboration with IM8-Bit. So I thought that was a fascinating little quirk in modern games preservation.
Nice. I have a couple of machines that could play NES games, so I could play that, a brand new NES game in 2025.
Yep, keeping the retro spirit alive there. So yeah, very curious to see that, and very much in favor of that. I think all proceeds from that game are going towards building out their mission there.
Yeah, they're doing some good work. I think there were some interviews with key people from the Video Game History Foundation on the Fun Factor podcast, which obviously covers retro video game magazines. I, as someone from a generation where I subscribed to video game magazines and really just devoured them in my youth, I definitely have strong feelings about them. Yeah, those are things that are worthy of preservation.
It is largely American magazines, I think, like Game Informer and Game Pro that are on there. There's not as many, I haven't found many of my Australian magazines that I used to consume that I've been wanting to dig back into those at some point. But, fingers crossed that if they're able to expand, we never know. Anyway, shall we get to our main course?
Yeah, let's do it. I think this time around you have two games, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, I just wanted to quickly talk about the little retro segment and start working through my backlog there first.
Cool. Why don't you start us off since I only have the one game?
Sure. I mean, I think I teased this last episode in that basically following on from our Final Fantasy II conversation, which I managed to softlock myself on and decided to move on, power forward, and jumped straight to Phantasy Star IV, The End of the Millennium. This is directed by Rieko Kodama, Toru Yoshida, and Kiichi Takeuchi, I think that's pronounced. It came out on the Sega Genesis in Japan 1993 and in the West 1995. So I did jump straight to 4, skipping 3. Partly I'd heard some mixed reactions to the third game, but also Phantasy Star 4 was on Nintendo Online, and having burnt myself on soft locking the second game, I just wanted, again, Path of Least Resistance, that has a very easy save state feature there. So, I mean, you've not played 4 at all, right, Mark?
No, I think I own the Sega Genesis collection on Steam, so I have access to all 3 Sega Genesis games. And I also own the collection on GBA, now that I think about it. So I own all 4
lots of options.
Phantasy Star games. But I've never gotten around to it, mostly because I've never finished number 2. And I got a little bit further. I'm getting lost on this icy planet on number 2. So I am going to finish it, but I will probably have to look up some guides.
It definitely was a frustrating game too, for all of the reputation it has in being a highlight of that series. I hit a lot of friction points. Surprisingly, for a time, seems to have gotten a somewhat lukewarm reaction, especially in regards to like the sort of graphical fidelity. I mean, we were talking last episode. I forget which one we're talking about, but basically how that graphical fidelity like is much less important now, essentially, right? Oh, Final Fantasy II, that was right. Like they skipped that entirely and went to the next generation of Final Fantasy games. And like in hindsight, that is like not really as important now. Graphical fidelity is just not as much of a priority. Looking back at these games, you can sort of view them through a much more... You see the value in them beyond that now, I think, and it's all sanded off that sort of curve. So, yeah, it really is interesting how many of those frustration points from 2 are sanded away here. The dungeon design is much more standard, I think. It's not really got that those real mazes and the labyrinths that you got from 2. It's the camera just works a lot better in navigating the world. It does still have that issue that you had with the buying things at the store, where you have to like buy potions one at a time. There's no stacking, which is you know buying 99 potions was a huge trope in the Final Fantasy series, for example. That's they still haven't quite solved that problem here. But all in all, it's a much more streamlined game by far. It's probably not my... I think 1 is still my favorite in terms of its innovation and just really inventive for its time. But 4 is definitely the most accessible, I think, and really streamlined and perfected what they'd been working towards all that time. It's a real culmination in the series. Echoes the first game in a lot of ways and sort of closes that book as a bookend, basically. It's bringing the story full circle. It's a pretty definitive ending for the series, but sort of has some fun references to the previous games. You do start out as playing again as Alice, or sort of equivalent of Alice, basically. But she's a complete girl boss in this game. She's just insulting everyone you come across. A very strong character in that sense. Unfortunately, they do play a very similar trick into the second game in terms of how they dispose of some characters, shall we say, without spoiling too much. But there are a lot of characters coming and going from your party. I thought that was quite inventive in... pretty constantly mixing up your party. Characters will join and then leave for a multitude of reasons. Like everyone seems to have their own motivations and priorities that like they'll just decide, okay, I've had enough. I don't think I want to go on this next part of the adventure with you. I'm just gonna stay here. you go on and do the hard part. So I thought that was it was playing with the storytelling there in some fun ways. And I mean, speaking of storytelling, it actually doesn't quite get to cut scenes, but I do play with these sort of manga panels overlaying in like quite dynamic ways. They'll have the panels appearing in like laying over each other and back and forth, and a lot of reactions and quite expressive forms of both the story and the character. I think that was quite well done for its time. So it's quite a lot packed in there in terms of the story and character expressivity. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of quality of life features it did add as well. Like there's a talk option in the menu, which is basically just what's our goal here? Where are we trying to go? This is a little reminder that, as you were saying, it's easy to get lost in these games. The little hints are basically to remind you if you get lost, which I thought is quite useful. I never really got lost, other than a couple of side quests. I mean that's in itself a pretty big innovation. It's probably not the first game, but that was somewhat rare for its time, having side quests. Basically, it's sort of Hunter's Guild, a series of those you can work through that sort of flush out the world a little more. Most of those are pretty obtuse in what you were supposed to do. You have to, like, walk around town and explore them. But I think the world did have a good sense of place as well in like, talking to everyone. Every town felt quite different. You get to learn these places and characters. Yeah, I thought this is a real highlight. It's, I think... its reputation has increased a lot retroactively compared to when it first came out, and people have started to acknowledge what it did with that series. I think that the Fantasy Star series really is special compared to Final Fantasy. It was obviously was innovating at the time, but Fantasy Star just went in some really different directions, I think, in its setting and characterization. I mean, animated sprites, I think, was still pretty new. I don't know when Final Fantasy introduced that, but from the first Fantasy Star, animated sprites were a big factor. And they're really quite creative. There's these really cool sort of creatures blinking in and out of resistance, like they're opening a portal in reality. And it's really quite inventive and creative. Some of these characters, quite eldritch monsters that are really quite out there. There is, I do have to say, there probably is not necessarily a content warning, but an accessibility warning. There is, like, I think that the final dungeon has some really intense, like, flashing light sequences. Like, you see that classic warning at the opening of games. I don't think this had that, but this game really does need a warning. There's some pretty intense strobing going on there. But, yeah.
I need to make a retraction.
Mm-hmm.
I think last episode I was talking about a new YouTube channel and I got the name wrong. I was calling it Catalog, but it turns out that the YouTube channel is actually called Datalog.
Yes.
So yeah. My apologies there. But I do distinctly remember in their Fantasy Star episode that they were talking about how they were using the animated sprites for the monsters as a real selling point in distinguishing this game from competition at the time, like Dragon Quest, which had, the static sprites designed by Akira Toriyama. But the animated sprites really made a big difference, and they had to do some funny things to make that work within the RAM limitations. Like, one of the sprites you probably recall from playing it is kind of this slimy ooze character that kind of, like, barfs out some slime out of its mouth. And then, because of the animation memory limits, they had to actually loop the animations forward and back. So the guy barfs out ooze and then he has to suck it back up into his mouth in exactly a reverse fashion. So I always thought that was a funny quirk out of that game.
Yeah, I mean, the animations were quite limited in that first one. It might just be the arm that's moving. Like, it's literally, it's a static sprite, but it's just the arm that's animated. Basically because of those limitations. I think I was just reading up about how there was at the last minute they wanted to add an image at the end credits of the characters, and they had to, like, remove a bunch of content from the game just to fit that one image at the very end. Like, so
a single still frame snapshot of the party.
Yeah, but they overcome a lot of those limitations by 4, and I think that really went all out here. I mean, it's really cool. One final detail is, like, the Land Rover, the vehicles, which were a big selling point of this, you actually, like, use those to fight now. Like, when you're in the Land Rover, there's, like, first person, like, you're fighting with the tank and shooting missiles at monsters instead of with your party, which is some nice touches. There was macros, which I think was a pretty early quality of life feature. I didn't really engage with those because the party members were rotating often enough it would break the macros. I found it a little fiddly, but I think for its time, people were quite impressed with those, that you could get quite creative in sort of setting up combos in advance. So yeah, I think this game has dated remarkably well. Definitely worth checking out. I think it's worth playing by itself if you don't feel like going back to the previous games. It stands alone pretty well.
Yeah, everything you're describing sounds super exciting. I think Phantasy Star does have a stronger legacy than most people give it credit for. I mean, at very least, it's a direct inspiration for later sci-fi based JRPG series like Star Ocean, which has gone on to create multiple entries of its own. And then potentially a lot of the concepts that they were trying to create were redone in a much later series like Mass Effect, going on that rover and traveling across planets and accessing different environments. So yeah, if you're a sci-fi fan and you like JRPGs, then you kind of owe it to yourself to check out Phantasy Star. You can check out Phantasy Star 4 on Nintendo Switch Classics online.
Yeah, I mean, I still advocate for playing the first game, but both for its like the first-person dungeons and the role-playing elements of that. It's a little harder to get into, though there is a version you can buy on Switch. I think it's the Sega Ages version that has some more modern quality of life features to streamline that. But yeah, 4 is definitely the pinnacle and of everything they've been working towards, and they're all great crapper on the series.
Very cool. All right, you talked about a classic JRPG. I'm going to be talking about a newer JRPG, although it's not a very traditional kind, not the kind of, you know, narrative-based Dragon Quest or Final Fantasy-like. This title, I thought it was a Japanese exclusive, but it turns out that it has a different Western name. So I'm going to give you two titles. In English, in the West, it's called Silent Hope. You can get this on Switch or Nintendo eShop or Steam, and in Japan it's called Frederica. So I'm going to be calling it probably Frederica because that's where I bought it on the Japanese eShop. The publisher is Exceed and the developer is Marvelous, who have put out other games like I think some of the Rune Factory games are from Marvelous as well. I'm not sure about all of them, but some of them are. So, you know, there's some legit developer props in there. It was released in 2023 in both Japan and on PC. And it's basically a single-player action RPG / JRPG. So think about like a Diablo, something like that, but not any multiplayer or anything of that sort. So very much like Diablo, the perspective on this game is isometric, kind of three-quarter perspective. You control this little chibi character, and you're only ever controlling one character at a time. And the story doesn't really matter. There's this princess trapped in a crystal or something like that, and she implores you to help out. For some reason, one of these characters is going to jump into this abyss portal, jump off a cliff and dive into this portal for some reason, deeper and deeper and deeper through various levels of monsters and enemies to collect resources. I don't know why, it's to save the princess or something.
Princesses love their crystals, so I don't know what it is.
It's true. Well, this one is kind of trapped like a birdcage inside this crystal. So, but she's very, very chatty. She loves to talk with the people in her village. So the setup of this game is not like a Diablo at all. It's set up more like a, could you call it a roguelike? I'm not sure. I mean, you definitely can die and you can fail in this game. And if you fail, you basically have to end your run immediately and you lose not all, but much of the items you've collected along the way. So what makes this game unique? I think one big selling factor for this game is the sheer number of heroes that you can play with. So there's 7 unique heroes, and each of them has a unique weapon and fighting style. And that's the primary difference with each of the characters. I wouldn't exactly call them classes. They're not like, doesn't exactly correlate to the classes in something like a Diablo, because each of these 7 characters also has 2 alternate classes that they can unlock over gameplay.
So, are these like named characters with like a personality, or just like a set of abilities?
They might have names, but I don't remember what any of them are. Okay. Like I said, the story doesn't matter. I just remember mostly their job. So the interesting thing is like the game is set in this like little village, and then most of the time most of the gameplay is set in the abyss, and then after a certain amount of time, you either die and get returned to the village, or you can take these warp portals and choose to go back to the village and bring back all of the loot and crafting materials that you collected along the way. So that's kind of the loop of the game. And each of the characters has a fighting role that they can take. You might be the slow hitting warrior with the long sword, or the fast two dagger rogue, or the archer, or something like that, or the long range spellcaster, those types of things. But these very same characters also have a job that they do in town, which is kind of cute. So I think like the sword fighter is like the blacksmith, and the spellcaster is an alchemist, and then the kind of other characters take on these other jobs, like the farmer and the cook. So it's kind of cute. You can kind of like level up these characters to fight in the dungeon, but they also have some sort of mechanical advantages for hanging out in the village too. And so all of these characters, all of these seven characters, serve all of those purposes. So that's kind of an interesting thing that you can develop over the course of time. So these characters, this is kind of like really simplified action RPG. The characters only have like three slots for equipment. Each character is going to have a unique weapon, but all of them can wear any kind of armor, and all of them can wear any kind of accessory. So you're going to be collecting these equipment, I guess you can call them like recipes. While you're fighting monsters, leveling up, they will drop recipes to differentiate from loot. They're not ready to go loot right away. They drop these recipes. You're destroying logs and crystal formations with your sword or whatever, and picking up the crafting materials. And you take those all back to town, and you can craft these newly found recipes and equip them to your fighters. But if you're taking out the sword fighter, you might collect recipes for staves or daggers or something. You're not necessarily collecting all equipment that's suitable to your character in that sense. Kind of like, you know, like in Borderlands, you can pick up equipment that's not necessarily for your class too. But of course, you can always go back to town and disassemble those for parts as well. So it's kind of that typical loop. You go in, go out, buff your character, level your character, and on and on.
I mean, are you encouraged at all to switch between the characters and balance those, or are you really just going to be doubling down on your class of choice?
Yeah, I think because it's single player, there's not really any, all of them are viable for single play. It's not like there are some classes that are better suited for, you know, kind of like DPS at range or something like that, and then there's a tank in the front. No, all of them have to be viable to play. I've played about three or four of the classes so far, and some of them I definitely prefer, and some of them I don't like at all. But that's largely going to be up to the individual, whether you want the action up close and personal, or whether you want it kind of more ranged and kind of dodgy. I actually like a little bit of both. So right now I am playing the character called I just call her the Farmer. And she, I think that might be her class name. She has a pitchfork as her weapon, which is like a medium range weapon. And she has, she wears this like frilly pink jacket, which is kind of hilarious for a farmer to wear. And she has these secondary abilities. Oh yeah. So each character has three special abilities on top of the regular attack. So these abilities are fixed for the character class. So the farmer will have three. You can invest in unlock them as you earn XP. You can unlock them in any order that you wish, but as long as you unlock the first level of each one, those are the only special abilities this character is ever going to have. So it can get a little bit repetitive there, but like I said, you can unlock alternate classes for that character to take on if you wish. So you could swap out. Each class has a different set of abilities, but they all kind of fall upon a similar theme. So I like the farmer. Let's see what her abilities are. She has like a dash forward ability where she can kind of strike through characters in a line. She has a kind of a confuse ability, which sends this like warp bubble of kind of like this balloon forward, and it just confuses any characters that it catches in its wake, and it makes them attack their allies. or something like that. And then the third ability she has is to eat a buff, eat food, which gives her a random buff. So that was quite cool, I thought. These are really like kind of innovative abilities. It's not anywhere near as kind of comprehensive as Diablo 4 or anything like that, but it still has enough room to play with to make the action pretty exciting and the play quite varied. So I think that's one of this game's strong points.
I mean, does the moment-to-moment combat feel like particularly tight or engaging? Like, something compared to like Diablo, or
it is engaging. It is engaging, and some would argue that the moment-to-moment action in a game like Diablo is not that exciting. A lot of it is just click, 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 and you know, shoot that way.
Watch for the shinies.
Exactly. A lot of that is just kind of like on impulse getting the job done. It's not nearly as precise and like finesse based as a tighter action RPG like Hades series, right? These action RPGs, despite being a new subgenre, are actually quite varied in what they can do. I would say it's closer along the lines of something like Cult of the Lamb. So we complained on that episode when we had Daniel Newman on when we were talking about Hades 2 that I brought up the title Cult of the Lamb, and I sort of complained that the action was like a little bit floaty and a little bit imprecise, and that's pretty much the case here with Frederica Silent Hope. The action is not so frenetic. It's actually pretty gentle. I would say that this is a strong recommendation for people who enjoy action RPGs, but they find a game like Hades 2, too intense. I would say the action never gets really intense. One thing that's really cool about this game is that there are a lot of optional challenges. Well, first of all, I didn't really explain kind of the overview. So I said you start in a village and then you jump down into the abyss. Every 10 or so levels, you will reach the end of a tier. So at the end of the first 10 levels, you reach tier 2. And then tier 2 has 12 levels, and so on and so forth. And you go down and down and down. And I guess it's not exactly a roguelite. You don't get necessarily more and more stuff the more and more consecutive runs you do. But if you want to ever return to the abyss, you will only be able to go to the start of a tier.
I mean, it sounds like a little bit like the first Diablo, which was basically just a dungeon delve, essentially. Like, get as deep into the dungeon as you can.
You know what it reminded me of a newer game, a more recent game, is the optional dungeons in Persona 5. Do you recall those, the ones with the little car?
Yes, yeah, I don't remember the name, but yeah.
Yeah, I forgot what that mechanism was called, but it's kind of like a little miniature dungeon you can take on while you're not performing one of the main ones. And it reminded me a lot of that. And potentially, maybe even that was inspired by this game. I think the years could potentially work out. Oh, by the way, another retraction. I totally screwed up the years for Arkham Horror and Metroid Prime. I knew I was getting a little bit over my skis there. But my premise still holds true. Any game that has a detective mode, you're going to be spending far too much time in detective mode and not in the regular view. Anyways, side tangent. Yeah, so the real trick is if you make it to level 7 of a tier and then return home, you're going to have to do those tiers, those levels all over again unless you reach the beginning of the very next tier. So that's a reason to keep plowing ahead.
It's more just like push your luck, I guess. Like the deeper you get, the higher the rewards are going to be.
Yeah, the push your luck is definitely there, but it's, like I said, it's gentle. Like this game gives you 2 healing potions for free each time you get refreshed back from the village, so that's a nice touch. But you, with some of the character classes, you don't end up needing them because there are built-in healing points throughout the stages. So each of the stages are kind of just built randomly, so that is very roguelike. The layouts are built randomly each and every time you visit them, but they all follow very, very samey parameters. They're using the same parts. They're using the same kind of like, what is it?
The tiles, train tracks. I guess. Okay.
Yeah, very much like that, and laying them out in slightly different arrangements. But it's very, very repetitive, very, very samey. But each level will definitely have a sort of a gate, which allows you to go to the following tier. Sometimes those gates will be blocked by a force field, and then you have to go to another point in the map to unlock that force field, and then you could proceed through the gate. Oftentimes you can just run through. And then at other points, some of the levels are just what's called a monster rush. So here's when the action does get a little bit more, you know, your heart starts beating a little bit more, because otherwise this is a very, very chill, very, very relaxed kind of a pace of game. When the monster rush happens, basically, it's sort of like in the original Zelda, where you enter a room and then they lock all the doors and all the monsters start attacking you. Except instead of just five bats or something like that, they do waves of enemies will poof in. So in that case, the entire level is just this small area here. And if you had a play style that was used to just running away and shooting from a distance, you're going to have a harder time of that because you're locked into this one space. So I like that. I like how that's forcing you to mix up your play style, at least periodically. Another thing that they do to mix up the play style is that every two or three levels within a tier, there will be these little shrines that will have an optional side goal. So the optional side goal will just be like a slight modifier to your playstyle. Like, finish this level without using a healing potion. Sometimes that's super easy. Sometimes that's really quite hard. Some of them will just be like, beat 10 monsters before you go down to the next tier. Because conceivably, you could just gun it to the gate and just go straight through. I found that most of those are pretty easy.
Are you leveling up as you go to get, like, do you need to more palpable before you go to the next level?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. You do level up your character, and that's the way you level up your side abilities, like I said. So that's very, very necessary. Yeah, it's noticeable. If you try and fight a monster with an underleveled character, you will notice the difference. And the third thing they do to mix up the kind of the pace of the game is that they have these things called, what are they called? They're called, I think they're called like memory portals, memory rifts. That's what they're called. So each, on certain levels, they will have these optional memory rifts. So like I told you, there's a gate to leave the level, but there will be a secondary door that looks quite ominous and distinct. And those are called memory rifts. Entirely optional. You can bypass them, no problem. But if you do choose to go in them, it's an entirely new level spawned off of the current level that you're in, and the enemies are like 3-4 times harder than what they are on a typical level of your current tier.
I mean, I know Diablo played with things like that, like the treasure goblin rifts and things, like extra sort of dual challenge rooms.
Yeah, I really like these as well, because early on, I was utilizing each and every one of these and like quite, you know, extending my run, getting a lot of rewards as a result, and really kind of intelligently utilizing my character's abilities to get the maximum results, because everything was self-contained and I had nowhere to run and the monsters were just coming at me like it was aliens or something like that. I could use my abilities to my advantage. I used my confuse bubble to confuse like 4 enemies and they would go on and attack 8 enemies, or I would use my plow forward ability to plow through, you know, 5 or 6 enemies instead of the typical 2 or 3 that I would in a much more less enclosed area. So those are fun and they help mix things up and kind of help ramp up the difficulty, which most of the time you don't have in this game. It's a very, very relaxed pace.
It's like cozy Diablo.
Kind of. And speaking of that, the art style in this game is very, very kind of chibi and cutesy. And this is going to cause a lot of people to probably not give it a second look. Like, the graphical fidelity is not what this game is screaming out or is not what you should buy this game for. It looks like a PS2, maybe a PS3 level game. It's cute, just barely adequate. Mostly what you're coming for is gameplay. And there are some gameplay hooks that I think make this a worthy title. First off, I'm going to list the bad. What's bad with this game? It's highly repetitive. It requires a lot of grinding. I already said the action is quite imprecise. It has this weird feature where it has this auto-aim feature where it just aims at the closest enemy, and that's where your attacks are going to go. So the boost forward or where that confused bubble I told you about, that's where it's going to go, not where your character is looking. And this kind of works against you if you're coming from action RPGs where aiming is really important, like a Hades or something like that. I was using that style as if I was playing Hades, and my attacks would just never go where I wanted them to go. But I think that's not the fault of the game. It's because I wasn't understanding. I was coming in with my own preconceptions.
Sounds more like an MMO auto attack mode where it will just, automatically target the nearest enemy or something.
Yeah, potentially. Like, I think this game is doing kind of like everything it can to de-stress and de-confuse, simplify, in other words, simplify a lot of these kind of more complex action RPG games. Like I said, it's like a cozy ARPG for a different, more chill crowd, let's just say. So that can work against you. There is really no story to speak of. That's another bad thing. And the character designs and the cutesy voice acting will definitely not work for everyone. Like I told you, that princess locked in a crystal is very, very chatty. Her voice acting in Japanese, which I'm listening to, is just over the top saccharine. Thankfully, there is a setting where you can turn it off. I had to turn it off after not too long because it was over the top.
Do we have to rescue the princess?
Exactly. Can we just lock her up? Maybe wall her up a little bit more. No, I will keep fighting the good fight to rescue the princess. Okay, so a few good things. So what's good about this game? I think it really lives or dies off the variety of characters. You're not going to like them all, but the variety and uniqueness is there. You will find a lot of play space to experiment and try stuff out. Like, this has more variety than a Diablo game does out of the gate without a bunch of different expensive expansions to attach on it. That's for darn sure. So that's really nice. The systems that I was talking about, like upgrading your equipment and the loop cycle of cooking and crafting, is not terribly innovative, but it's there. It's solid, it works, and this game is somewhat meditative as you keep playing it. It, like I said, it's very simple, the graphics are not intense, but because it's not so intense, you can kind of just kind of go with the flow and relax. It's not a stressing game. So that's really good. And like I said, this game, it's really nice that you have an action RPG that's not a very online game with loot packs. No battle passes here. No online verification.
Where you're constantly feeling the pressure to just spend a little bit more here. Smooth it out.
Yeah, exactly. This is just kind of like a throwback with some mild modern twists. Like, this would be a great game to play on an airplane to just kind of while the way the time, maybe you listen to a podcast at the same time or even watch a movie. This is like an ARPG you can play on the couch as a second screen experience. So I do recommend this game. Get it if it's on sale. I think I got it for the equivalent of $20 or something like that from the Japanese eShop. It's intriguing to me. That's why I didn't end up purchasing it. But if you're not sure, you're sitting on the fence, I think the Japanese edition at least came with a demo. It will let you fight through the first tier and fight the... I forgot to mention, at the end of each tier, there's a boss fight. So you can see if it was worth it to try out some of the characters. It won't even take you that long either. I think it'll take you about an hour and a half or something to get through the 10 levels, depending on how fast you go. So that is... What is the English name called? This is...
Silent Hope.
Silent Hope. and in Japan also called Frederica from Exceed Games.
Good for Marvelous. Killing time. Got it.
There you go. All right. Do you have another game to cover?
Yeah, well, I've promised that I have a tabletop game to cover. This last month, I've not played a game with another person other than my daughter for like a month now. It's been, everyone's been busy. Some of you, obviously, I have been playing some solo games. However, I recently spoke a bunch about some word games I've been playing, including one called Paperback, which is a deck building word game, competitive game. A few years ago, there was another game came out called Paperback Adventures. This was in 2022, designed by Tim Fowers and Sky Larson, published by Fowers Games, and art by Ryan Goldsberry. And so I'd seen this floating around. I enjoyed Paperback, and I really struggled to see what this was doing differently. I mean, it's already paperback, it's hardback. There's been a few iterations on this system, and I was struggling to interpret what exactly this is between the, like, it's a solo game that you're fighting monsters, and the product setup is a little strange. We have to buy a core box, but that core box by itself doesn't let you play the game. You have to buy the core box plus one of these supplemental boxes. And I couldn't wrap my head around what the setup is. So I dove in, I picked up the core box and one of these supplemental games called Damsel is the one I have. And in reading through it, it immediately became clear, oh, it's Slay the Spire. And pretty explicitly inspired by Slay the Spire. Curiously, I mean, someone had told me, I'm not sure, I wasn't able to validate this, but someone told me this started out as a Slay the Spire adaptation. That there was some intention to turn this into a Slay the Spire board game, that they ended up taking it into a much more explicit one-to-one adaptation. Obviously, we've already covered that game. That came out later. The official Slay the Spire board game came out a year or so later. Curiously, both of these have taken some similar lessons and sort of innovations in how they approach deck building. So basically, you're going to start out with a deck. Each of those three supplemental boxes, there's three right now, I think there's more coming, but there's three right now, Damsel, Plot Hook, and Ex Machina is the other one. Each of those is basically a character in the Slay the Spire sense that are going to play slightly differently, but each of those start with a deck of cards, and you're going to draw four of those cards and then try to spell a word to attack a monster. So you're basically going through three acts, the same as Slay the Spire, but each act is basically just two battles. You'll fight a lackey and then a boss. So it's a pretty streamlined framework. But in that, you're fighting, you're forming a word and attacking the monster, but how these words interact is very much multi-use cards. Each of these cards is doing a bunch of different things, because on one side of the card, you'll have some symbols that tend to be block style mechanics. On the other side of the card, you'll have a different set of symbols that tend to be attack. And there's some other like energy and other sort of things that tend to go in there as well. But basically, when you choose your word, you're going to be splaying the cards in one in either left or right, which will determine which of those symbols are visible. So you'll splay them to the left and suddenly all of the block symbols are visible, or you'll splay them to the right so all the attack symbols are visible. So it's a somewhat binary system, like whether you're going to go for an offensive or defensive mode for any particular turn. There's some nuance there as you go. But then also the card on top, every card has a unique ability that might say you do extra damage or generate some energy or some specific card ability that you only trigger the ones on top of the stack. So it'll either be the first letter in the word or the last letter in the word, depending on how you splay the cards. So, I mean, already just in forming a word is the only part of the challenge here. You're then immediately faced with multiple other options, like, again, whether you splay left or right, which card you want to go on top. And it really forces you to think about, like, you might not want to go for the longest word or the first word that comes to mind. You might very quickly think of a word, but then, this letter on top doesn't really work. I need to rearrange them into a slightly different order to try and maximize those settings. Or I want this word to be on top, but I need to go defensive, which doesn't work. So I need to find a new word where that letter is last. And so you're really having to improvise on the fly and experiment and rearrange words in some fun ways. I mean, as I explained in some of the other deck building, like paperback, I guess, these decks seem to be pretty small. You start out with 10 cards in your deck, and most of the time, whenever you add something, you're also removing a card. You're just replacing them. You do add a couple over the course of the game, but you'll probably only end up with like 15 cards max. So you'll generally have a pretty good idea what's in there. So you can start planning your deck around specific words or various like clusters of words. So you like, again, you want to have letters that will work well together, and you can easily rearrange in particular ways. And, I mean, you really do have a lot of tools in how you leverage those words, both those symbols and which way you slant them. But then you've got the energy that you're generating over the course of the game that you can spend you'll have these item cards, basically. You can spend energy to activate these items that will let you draw a new card, perhaps, or apply a debuff and do this variety of other things. You've got these MacGuffins, they're called, that are basically very much like the Slay the Spire items you get. They're kind of like passive upgrades. Some of the more the bigger ones are quite powerful in that they'll just let you draw an extra card, or say something like when you spell a word with five or more letters, you do some extra damage. So that they will really let you build into a new synergy in a way that each run will be a little different and how you form your strategy. So yeah, it's really quite a lot of options here in your toolbox for how you navigate this. The bosses are all quite asymmetric, or the enemies broadly, they're all multi-stage. Like they're all, you fight the monster, when you remove all their HP, you flip the card over and there's another stage, but they all work in pretty different ways. You have to anticipate their attacks and puzzle out how the best to approach them, because some will have very high block value or be super aggressive, and so you have to really form a strategy around those specific bosses. And so each boss does feel quite unique. It can feel a little luck dependent, based, like, because you draw the enemies randomly, and it can feel like sometimes one just doesn't really jive with your strategy. But ultimately, it is a very deterministic game. Like, it's luck dependent as to what cards you draw at the start of your turn. But once you have those words in your hands, everything is deterministic. You know exactly what the monster is going to do this turn. You know exactly how much damage you're going to do. There's no luck beyond that. It's very much input luck. I think you call it, like, it's very front loaded, essentially. So you can feel quite clever in how you manipulate the board state and puzzle that out. There are some options for, like, basically the monsters are working through this sort of list of attacks, very similar to how the Slay the Spire board game works. They'll have these five options and they'll work through from top to bottom, but you can there are things that will let you basically bump that down, so you can be quite clever in manipulating them in that way. So I think each monster has a weakness, which is ostensibly a vow. Like, there'll be one vowel for every monster. It might be the E, which basically means you have a free E. As an E card, you can use that in any word, which adds some extra power there. So, yeah, it's a really quite dynamic word game. It's quite tactical. Like, it's not just about spelling words. It's incredibly, like, it's quite robust in the board game tactical mechanics on top of just the spelling words. So I think if you're just looking for a word game, this is pretty complex, but vice versa. Like, I think both of those work really well in parallel with each other. You probably do want to, like, enjoy both word games and tactical deck building games, but it's a really strong dynamic system for people who love both of those.
Yeah, this sounds quite a bit more complex than the game that it's based on, Paperback, from Fowler's Games as
which
well.
Which was really more of a Dominion-style game, which is basic, like, in terms of the structure. You're still trying to spell words, but how you're building the deck, it was basically just build up, spell a big word, get a points card, and about it.
Dominion meets Scrabble, sort of
thing. Yeah.
That's input randomness, by the way, coined.
That's the word I was thinking of, yes.
Jeff Engelstein and partner and podcast co-host, I forget his name at the time, from the original cast of the Ludology podcast.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as someone who has struggled with word games, there can be some anxiety when you're playing a multiplayer word game and just staring at the cards and making something happen, and that the time pressure can be a bit of an anxiety killer. Like, obviously, being a solo game, that it just doesn't have that issue. Basically, you can just sit there and stare at the words as long as you want. But it's also generally just four cards. You can expand upon that and double down into longer words if you want to. But just forming a word with four cards isn't as big of an ask. It's, with four letters, I should say. So it tends to flow pretty quickly. Obviously, it does still have that issue, as with all word games, where in terms of improving and getting better at this, it's only going to be as good as the words you know. You can improve on the tactical strategy, but you can't just... the only way to learn more words is to, like, you know, just look through the dictionary or study. Like, it's hard to improve that sense of the getting better at the start of the game, obviously. I do have to, like, have a dictionary in... Is that a word? Sometimes. Which is obviously going to be a struggle with any word game.
Yep, you need that dictionary for figuring out disputes in Scrabble, too, for sure. And it was Ryan Stern, by the way. Jeff Engelstein and Ryan Stern was the original cast of Ludology.
Very cool.
All right, anything else for Paperback?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely keen to check that out, try some of the other characters and see how the asymmetry in those works. There is a second edition with, like, a fourth character that was crowdfunded earlier this year, I believe. But yeah, the rules book is a bit weird. The product release is a little weird. It's a wonky product, but once you've got your head around it, it's an incredible deck building experience. It's really shows the strength of word games and tactical deck building games. It's a great little fusion.
Very cool. All right, I think we should quickly do a dessert section, because we've actually been talking for quite a while. If that's all right, I'm going to be talking about a book. Shall we move into dessert?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so my book this time around is not a Japanese novel. Hurrah, hurrah. It's actually an entry of genre fiction. This is originally published in 1992, BattleTech: Decision at Thunder Rift. So BattleTech is that game featuring giant hulking war machines of 2,200 ton walking tanks, essentially, that was, I think, originally from Faza, now by WizKids, if I'm not mistaken, or was it Catalyst?
Catalyst? One of the I think other. It's Catalyst, yeah.
It changes hands all the time. And they're still publishing these books, even newer entries. There's over 100 novels in this series, and I picked this up in a Humble Bundle a little while ago. But you can also find these books on that Kobo Plus service that I was talking about last episode. They have all the old, many of the old BattleTech and Shadowrun novels, if you're curious about where to find those. So this is the very first one. Like I said, it's from the 90s, and this is a genre fiction, and it's based off of games. And we always think, oh, D&D is just, you know, just pumping out these movies and these mugs that will put their logo on it, and we'll just try and spin this media into a media property. But they were doing it way back then, too, and even earlier. And I really like kind of books set in game worlds, because those game worlds already had a lot of world building, and they're also meant to be played in. So it means there are many planets that you can visit, and there are many vehicles.
It's a big sandbox to play in.
Exactly. It's much more interesting than the extended universe of something like Star Wars, which was only ever intended to be like 6 hours on a screen way back in the 70s and 80s, right? It wasn't meant to be the expanded thing until dollars got involved. Anyhow, BattleTech: Decision at Thunder Rift. This is... BattleTech, I've always felt weird about. I love giant robots. It's just sort of in my DNA. Growing up in the 80s and Japanese-Canadian, giant robots are fantastic. They're in so many of my favorite, you know, media properties, like Macross/Robotech, and borrows a lot. BattleTech has always been weird because it's a literal pastiche. It tries to pull so much stuff from so many different sources. Like, it's a little bit of Dune, it's a little bit of Robotech, it's a little bit of Star Wars, a little bit of Traveller, another popular sci-fi game, and definitely a whole bunch of Warhammer. and Warhammer 40K thrown in there for good measure. What I like about it is that it's a little bit less grimdark than Warhammer, which I've had an even harder time getting into in my gaming career.
It feels like it would be hard to capture the excitement of giant mechs in a non-visual medium, though. How well does it pull that off?
It actually pulls it off surprisingly well. So this is the first novel. So it's got a particular challenge. It's an origin story, and it's also trying to set up a media property that maybe people aren't entirely aware of yet. Maybe their, you know, maybe their friend has like some BattleTech pieces, and then they just pick this up in a cheap used bookstore or something like that, and they're trying to get into it. So the author goes to great lengths to visually describe the makeup of the variety of classes of mechs that are throughout the universe. And of course, it doesn't cover everything. It doesn't cover all, you know, dozens and dozens of mech models that are out there, but it does have actually a sizable glossary of the mech definitions at the end of the book, which I was pleasantly surprised to see. And it also covers some just general terminology, like they have some built-in like acronyms for certain types of weapons and hover vehicles and particle cannons that are just generally used throughout, and even non-mech weaponry, and kind of like the spacey sounding terms that are used throughout the BattleTech universe as well. So that was also featured in the book. That's a nice touch. But I think where this book succeeds is in the action. The author is pretty terrible. Not a terrible person. Just the writing is pretty terrible. Like, the plot is nothing to write home about, ironically. Just really, really cheesy, derivative stuff. But the action scenes are written well.
Okay.
And that's what counts a lot.
For a basically game.
Exactly. This game is intended to recreate bombastic, violent, hectic military encounters in giant hulking war machines, and it does that really well. So I'll give that to its credit. The action starts fast and furious right away. The primary character is not someone to be terribly sympathetic for. He's this kind of like nepo baby from like a house, a royal house, essentially, pretty much almost like a little princeling, but his life is turned upside down when his castle is attacked. You know, they're also trying to build in like the mythology of knights and nobility and stuff into this sort of stuff as well, which is something that Warhammer also tries to do. And it does that to various degrees. It's also a product of the 80s and 90s as well, so it's got that sort of military-industrial complex flavor built into it also.
A little propaganda thrown in there, yeah.
Absolutely. And that leaves me with a little bit of skeevy feeling. It's like as if someone's fully bought into a series like G.I. Joe. It's like, I never bought into that stuff. I never bought into rah-rah America. I never bought into Rambo or that sort of stuff. But, you know, there's something to be said about just hard and fast action with sci-fi war machines. So that's going for it, too. You know, the depictions of women, there are a couple of women in this novel, are really, really shallow and stereotypical. Essentially, these are kind of like throwaway characters to be love interests of the protagonist. His name is Grayson Death Carlisle, by the way. His middle name is Death, so let me just say how...
He's born for this role.
Exactly. Just how terrible that is. The enemies are like these mustache-twirling baddies and things like that. To their credit, it seems to be a variety of, you know, nationalities and ethnic groups, even though these are all conceivably humans spread across many, many parsecs of space. They seem to have a lot of non-European based names in there, to their credit. Many of them are the baddies, so to speak. But in a game, an expandable game like this, one person's baddie might be a hero in a different campaign. So you never know where you sort of stand with this.
I mean, if your protagonist's middle name is Death, is he really the good guy?
Yeah, and this is the first, apparently, in a trilogy called the Grey Death Legion trilogy. So it's basically an origin story. This guy comes from somewhat highborn, and then he loses everything and he has to build it all back up. So he has to put a ragtag fighting force together, even maybe like scavenging some mechs along the way. And it's the excitement of being able to survive. And of course, wouldn't you know it, by the end of it, he turns out into leading a new but promising mercenary force who can be hired out to fight in some war on the various fronts throughout this war-torn galaxy. So it promises a lot. It is, like I said, very, very predictable, very, very derivative, and very bad in many ways. But I think the good aspects of it win out if you know what you're getting into. This is like cheap, kind of pulpy paperback material here. So know what you're getting into. But if you, you know, if you like genre fiction from that time, you might enjoy it. I enjoyed reading it till the end.
Will you be continuing, do you think?
I'll try to, but I think I'm going to be jumping over into some of my other genre fiction that I've been enjoying more. Maybe I'll even talk about the Star Trek The Next Generation novel that I've been reading since finishing Decision at Thunder Rift. And maybe I'll also jump back into a Shadowrun novel here and there. But anyways, that's all I have to say about Decision at Thunder Rift.
So, yeah, I had a little show that I've been watching, perhaps you've heard of it, called Star Trek The Next Generation. My wife and I have been working through this very slowly for the last couple of years. We're now closing in on the end of season 5. I know we're coming up on a big batch of episodes that are quite well-renowned, like Time's Arrow is one a name I've heard tossed around a lot. But there's a few other episodes that have just come up in this last little bundle that are worth particularly highlighting, I think, that really stood out to me. I mean, one is called The Outcast, which is basically, there's a race of these aliens that are all non-binary. And one of the characters identifies as a woman. I mean, and implies that there's a lot of other people within her race that also do so. And I mean, curiously reading through this, it seems like at the time this was intended as very much a queer, like a homosexual analogy. And I think there were some issues at the time and currently with how that analogy works. But it, looking through it now in 2025, it actually works remarkably well as a trans analogy, I think. There's actually like this talk in there of like Riker is just trying to know what pronouns to use. I mean, when this came out, what it was probably like mid-90s, I mean, pronouns weren't, there wasn't really a lot of discussion around those at the time, like standardized in popular culture at the very least. And I think that side of it is treated quite respectfully. The ending is a little disappointing in how the way the character ends up, shall we say, without spoiling anything. But I think it's an episode that dates remarkably well for the current time. It's a very forced analogy, obviously. But I mean, if you only have to look at the news to know that we're perhaps in need of some of those more obvious messages right now.
I remember watching this episode very distinctly. Even in real time, I thought the performer they got to play the character opposite Jonathan Frakes was really, really fantastic.
Mm.
Fantastic performer. Great performance. And the analogy was like very clear, even watching that as a young person back then. But, you know, Star Trek has always been woke, has always been trailblazing in representation. It had the first interracial kiss on television, had the first same-sex kiss, different series as well, and the newer series also have queer relationships and non-binary full-time cast members as well. So it has always been woke, always will be woke, and is always doing, in a good sense, the original sense, pushing the boundaries forward. And yeah, it's doing impressive things. Like, I know that the trans community really has attached to the Jadzia Dax character from Deep Space Nine.
I've seen memes of that, yeah.
A little bit of a sidestep, so I don't want to delve into that too deeply, but this is around the same time Deep Space Nine was airing at the same time as later seasons of TNG.
Yeah, obviously, it's a little hit and miss with how well they represent some of these issues. There's certainly been some very weak episodes this season, but I think broadly these last couple of seasons have become really polished in how they're approaching these more advanced concepts. I mean, the other quick one I wanted to talk about was an episode called I, Borg, which they basically capture one of the Borg, who are the big villains of that series, and essentially they deprogram him from the collective consciousness. But there's this, the question is, they want to like send him off to they want to like basically attach a sort of a logic bomb and send him back to like destroy the rest of the Borg, and everyone is on board with this until Beverly Crusher is like, what do you mean by annihilate? Like, it felt very 12 Angry Men. Like, there's one person who's willing to ask, like, what do you mean, like, basically genocide? Like, is that justified by any means necessary? And one by one, everyone is forced to basically confront that question, which I think was a really fascinating exploration of that concept. I mean, it is a little strange. Like, there's not exactly consistency across the series and all these episodes. It feels like it's a little contrived with like whether deprogramming the Borg is even a possibility. And these characters are basically there. Like, the characters will shift somewhat sometimes to sort of force the story of the episode. So it's a little strange sometimes to wrap your head around the consistency of that. But I think the message there does come across really well.
Some of the best episodes of Star Trek altogether are when the mainline characters oppose each other. You know, there's good episodes where, like, some guest character will come in and sort of be a jerk, and the main cast has to teach them the right way of thinking. But when the main cast have philosophical disputes and they have to come to terms with each other, I think that's when the drama is the most powerful, when characters actually develop and evolve. And, you know, it wouldn't be the first time some of these, like, let's just say, you know, the G word, like, you know, genocidal questions and ethical questions come up. Particularly Voyager has a lot of those cases, being off on their own, meeting new types of species. And don't want to give too many spoilers away, but this might not be the last appearance of our good friend Hugh, the Borg.
Yeah. I'm curious to see where that goes and how they play with that idea. And yeah, looking forward to a few more very renowned episodes coming up soon. So yeah, hoping to wrap that up and move on to like Deep Space Nine, which I've heard a lot of good things about too.
Yeah, happy to talk about more Trek at any time. I've watched those episodes exhaustively, and I can just like picture them in my mind's eye, each and everyone.
Looking forward to the Deanna Troi is Cake episode.
Ah, a classic.
Anyway, if you have any questions or comments on today's games or Star Trek episodes or recommendations for Sega history books, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. Go check out our episodes in video form on YouTube. We'll post all of our new episodes there. If you do want to delve into our sort of back catalog of earlier episodes, they're only available in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. We would love to hear your feedback in either platform there. Like and subscribe, share it with a friend who might be interested in the sort of material that we put out. We live for your comments and feedback. Or you can reach out to us directly. I'm on Blue Sky myself as Mark Uasa, MarkYuasa, at bsky.social. And yourself, Daniel.
You can find me at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the OmniGamers Club account there as well.
All right. Been a good talk, and I'm excited that we're talking about some retro media as well, not just retro games.
Living in the 90s.
Exactly. But I do promise I will get back into the tabletop space. Been thinking about talking some TTRPGs. Been playing through a little bit of Call of Cthulhu with my neighbor group. That's been going well. We played a little bit of RPGs at our friendly local game store a few weeks ago. And maybe even you and I will get some game sessions in over the holiday break.
Well, speaking of the 90s, we've been playing a big TCG from the 90s.
Oh, yeah, that'll be a bigger delve. Single game episode, we'll be talking about that. So please look forward to that. Hint, hint, there might be some Pokemons involved and some cards involved.
My daughter just started playing Pokemon Violet for the first time, and like seeing her, a big milestone, choosing her first starter Pokemon. So it's been fun watching that.
Yeah, and I've been getting some recommendations for, I think I'm going to try and play my first mainline Pokemon game. I'm thinking maybe GBA might be a good place to get
Black and White, I've heard, is good.
Okay, all right. I'm getting various opinions from various sources, but we'll see how it goes, and I'll be reporting on that as well.
Look forward to it. Well, thank you, Mark, and thanks everyone for listening. And remember to have a balanced diet of games. Bye.
Bye.